Welcome back to Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers, the podcast devoted to exploring the frontiers of psychedelic medicine and what it takes to cultivate a healthy mind, body, and spirit. I'm Dr. Steve Thayer, and today my co-host, Dr. Reed Robison, and I are joined by none other than Dr. Richard Schwartz. Dick is the creator of the Internal Family Systems, or IFS, model of therapy, a therapeutic modality that's seen a recent spike in popularity, especially in the psychedelic therapy space. Dick's been on a lot of podcasts lately where he describes the basic tenets of IFS, even demonstrates how it's done. So if you're interested in that kind of content, you can find it elsewhere. On this episode, we decided to take it a different direction. We talk about the origin story of IFS, how psychedelics affect the parts that comprise the internal family system, what psychedelic research Dick would like to see be done in the future, especially with IFS, how IFS is used to treat eating disorders, and how IFS might be thought of as a spiritual practice in addition to a psychotherapy model. Of course, we talk about more things. Dick was very generous with his time. We had a great conversation, and hopefully you'll enjoy it. If any of you listening are looking for good training and education pursuant to becoming a psychedelic therapist, you can check out Numinous's programs. Click on the link in the show notes or go directly to numinous.com/our-training-selection. You can use the code PTF10 for 10% off selected trainings. If you'd like to support the show, you can do so by subscribing to the show, by leaving a rating or review in places like Apple Podcasts or Spotify, and of course, you can share the episode with anybody you think might be interested. Without further ado, here is Dr. Richard Schwartz. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers. Reed and I are honored to be joined today by Dr. Richard Schwartz, Dick Schwartz. We've wanted to have Dick on the podcast for a long time. He's a man in high demand these days, with internal family systems being very, very popular right now in psychotherapy spaces, in particular in the psychedelic psychotherapy spaces. So welcome, Dick.
Thank you, Steve and Reed. Great to be with both of you.
Why don't you introduce yourself to our audience for maybe the few of the people listening who don't know who you are?
I developed this thing that's called Internal Family Systems, originally therapy. It's sort of transcended just being a psychotherapy now. And that's what I'm known for the most. I'm happy to leave it there.
And I think, is it marriage and family therapist by training? And you started most of your career doing that, family therapy, couples therapy?
Yeah, I have a PhD in that and started out as a pure family therapist. I was one of those obnoxious ones who thought we'd found the Holy Grail and that people that mucked around in the inner world were wasting their time because we could change all that just through changing family structures. And then found that that wasn't true. And that was about 40 years ago. This is like the 40-year anniversary of the discovery of all this.
Wow.
Wow. And maybe we could spend a moment or two on the origin story, because one of the first meetings we had when I was talking about the eating disorder work we do, you mentioned there's a connection to eating disorders and the origin of IFS. I wonder if you could share a little more on that.
Yeah. So back when I thought family therapy was the bomb, I wanted to prove it. And my hero, Salvador Minuchin, had done some kind of study with anorexia and claimed to have had really good results, although never published in a journal as far as I know. And so I wanted to show that we could do the same with a different eating disorder, which was bulimia. And so colleague Mary Jo Barrett and I recruited a bunch of bulimic kids and their families and set out to prove that we could get kids to stop binging and purging just by improving family relations. And again, found that that didn't happen, that a bunch of my kids anyway didn't realize they'd been cured after the families were restructured. And out of frustration, I began asking them why, and they began talking this language of parts that was sort of foreign to me at the time, because I came, like most everybody, with the idea that there's just one mind and different thoughts and emotions, and that people that had these autonomous inner entities were crazy, that they'd been blown apart by trauma and must have DID or something like multiple personality disorder, something like that. So it was disturbing at first to hear these kids talk about these parts as if they had a lot of separation from each other and autonomy. They had relationships with each other. And I thought, oh my God, these kids are scarier than I thought, or sicker than I thought, until I noticed I've got them too. And a lot of mine are as extreme as theirs in some ways. But the bulimic clients were talking about, they would start usually with the critic. They had these very severe, punishing, critical parts that would attack them if they ever made a mistake or they didn't look right or whatever. And that would bring up another part that they describe as feeling totally worthless and alone and empty and young. And that feeling was so distressing that the binge would come in to take them away from that. But then the act of the binge would bring the critic back, who's now calling him a pig on top of all the other names. And that would go to the heart of that young, worthless, lonely, empty part. So the binge would have to come back, and they'd be in that sort of vicious cycle for days. And so initially I thought, okay, let's try to control these parts. And so I would set out to have my client argue with the critic and stand up for herself and try to control the binge. And my clients were getting worse, but I didn't have any alternatives until the first client I was aware of who cut herself also and had a pretty extensive sex abuse history. And I decided we weren't going to let her out of my office until that cutting part had agreed not to do it to her. And by then I'd heard about the Gestalt empty chair technique, where you have a client sitting in a chair across from themselves and be the part, talk as the part, and then you can have them change chairs and be themselves. And so I was doing that process. And I decided one session I wouldn't let the client leave until the part had agreed not to cut her that week. And I went up badgering it for a couple hours, and it finally agreed not to. And of course, I opened the door of the next session. She's got a big gash down the side of her face. And that just, I collapsed emotionally when I saw that and spontaneously said, why do you do this to her? From a place of curiosity rather than from the coercive place. And the part started talking about where it was stuck in the past and how it needed to protect her in various ways. And that was a big turning point in the history of this work, because I shifted. And after I'd heard the part's story, not only felt curious, but had a kind of appreciation for the heroic role it played in her life and could extend that to the part. And it broke into tears because everyone had tried to get rid of it and vilified it. Mm-hmm. And so that moment actually in history changed the course of this, because from that point on, I just helped people get curious about their parts, even the ones that were driving them crazy, and found that when I could do that, the part would reveal its secret history of how it got into that role and how much it didn't like the role, but thought it needed to keep the client safe. So anyway, that's the history with eating disorders and.
It's a profound story of that young woman. It makes me think of how in so many eating disorder treatment centers, when you're admitted as a patient, you get a book called Life Without Ed, where it's this concept that most individuals on an eating disorder recovery journey read, where the eating disorder part is kind of personified as this character Ed, and that is to be kind of gotten rid of. And And so I was wondering how you recommend people take in that kind of perspective, because I agree with you 100%, the stance that there are no bad parts and we can't get rid of parts, but we can get rid of burdens. But how do you weave it into this culture of really viewing it that way?
Yeah, it's, you know, it's been a tough culture to break into because there is that attitude about Ed. And I've actually had conversations with the author of that book about it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's tough because that's really the big problem with the whole field. That the reason eating disorders are so tough to treat is because people attack Ed. And that mm-hmm. always backfire. Either one of two outcomes, either Ed just gets stronger and more determined to protect, or they do succeed in exiling Ed, but they wind up very, very rigidly controlled by these manager parts that are, because they become very afraid of anything that might trigger Ed again, who would come back with a vengeance. So, and that's the way a lot of quote unquote recovered eating disorder clients live.
And so the stance of curiosity, compassion, listening to the secret story of the part instead of just getting out the rocket launcher and aiming it at it is the way to go, that it sounds like.
Yeah, but that only does part of the job because, you know, it'll soften when it feels finally accepted and witnessed, but it can't really leave its job usually until the parts it protects have been healed. And so we go to the eating disorder, and this is true for any addiction, not expecting it to change, just to get a sense of what it's protecting. And the operative question for that is, ask the part what it's afraid would happen if it didn't do this inside. And answering that, they'll say you would feel a lot of emotional pain, or you would feel worthless, or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say, if we could go to that part and heal it so it wasn't such a threat that you would feel that, would this one have to keep making you binge in this case? And the answer is usually no, but I don't think you can do that.
Mm-hmm.
So then we have to negotiate permission to go to the part it protects. But once we get there, if we can get the part to show where it's stuck in the past, because it turns out most all these parts are stuck in the past, they still think you're 5 years old and
yeah.
they have to do what they do. So once you witness what happened and how bad it was when the part got hurt, and then I would have you go into that scene and be with it and then take it to a good place, then it's willing to unload the hurt. And once it does that, it naturally transcends or transforms into being a happy little kid. And then we can bring in the eating disorder part to see it doesn't need those services anymore and find a new role for it.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And reminds me of a question from my level one IFS training that I finished recently that remains is, what do you call an exile when it becomes that happy little kid? Like, is there a term for it?
Not really. It's just a unburdened happy little kid part.
Yeah. Yeah, just a curiosity of what this self-actualized system, knowing the work is never done, right? And something else I wanted your take on is, like, you know, how do you view the lifelong journey of this and how do you use it personally? But I was just a curiosity as well as, is there a term for the unburdened exile?
Well, it's interesting because I just so happened to have there's a woman named Mariel Pastor who made a chart called the unburdened internal system.
Nice. Oh, I've seen that.
Have you seen that? Yeah.
Yeah, it's a great drawing, like a yin yang kind of mm-hmm. you know, beautiful image.
In terms of my journey, yeah, I have had many opportunities to be told that I needed to do work on myself, and if I'm proud of anything, it's that I wound up doing that. And so I'm far less burdened than I once was. I still occasionally have parts get triggered, but it's a lot easier to live this way, where formerly very polarized parts now get along well, and I don't have critics yelling at me all the time like I did, and that worthless part feels pretty good now. So,
yeah, that's really neat. So when parts come up for you, when triggered, this is just another curiosity, given your place in this work and as a teacher and mentor to so many, does this processing and parts work happen for you on the fly? Do you set aside time to go in there deeply yourself? Do you see a therapist for your own work?
Yeah, good question. So it's all three, really. So, as I go through my day, like getting ready for this podcast, for example, I would just go inside, notice if any parts are nervous or need anything, mm-hmm. ask them to trust me to handle this, which so far they are. And mm-hmm. As I do that, I'll notice shifts. I'll notice space opening more. I've got like 4 or 5 markers to see how much self I'm embodying. One of which is, how open is my heart? Do I have a big agenda or not? You know, a lot of those kind of things. And
yeah.
And those eight C words that characterize self, I just notice, how calm am I? Am I curious? Do I feel compassion, et cetera? And so if there are any deviations from that, I know that's a part, it's a protector. And so I'll go to that and I'll ask it to just give me more space. So I'm doing that. And then if I do get triggered, I'll bookmark that and I'll say, okay, I do need to set aside time to follow this, what we call trailhead, to see what part is coming from this. Like if I get a big rush of emotion, or if I have a strange belief come in, then later I'll find time to check that out and see if there's a part that needs to be unburdened. And I do have a person that I do that work with who's not exactly a therapist, but is a spiritual person who,
cool.
I don't talk about this all the time, but can channel my guides. And my guides have made it clear that this model didn't come out of my little brain. It came out, I'm sort of channeling this. So, and they're very eager to help me unload whatever's getting in the way.
Yeah. And guides could be ancestors or any kind of guide.
Yeah. Yeah, just sort of spiritual wisdom that's not a part of my system necessarily.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Oh, thanks for sharing. And it reminds me of in the level one training, how neat it was to do some ancestral work facilitated by Kay and the TAs. That was just so profound. I loved that part of it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's all become a big part of IFS, the legacy burdens and the ancestor spirits.
And the ancestral gifts too, like looking for burdens and the gifts was a really neat perspective.
Yeah. Yeah, Kay is really good with that.
So Dick, this is a curiosity of mine. As somebody who hasn't been formally trained in IFS, but has, you know, read your books and participated in some trainings, not included level one training. But I've heard you and others who are experts in IFS talk about how IFS has sort of transcended the therapy boundaries. It's not just a psychotherapy. You know, I've heard you talk about IFS being used by coaches who might not describe themselves as therapists, but also, like we're talking about now, IFS, or the concepts behind it as a practice of spirituality. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious if you could talk more about what does IFS as a spiritual practice look like?
Sure. Yeah, it's a good question. And it does relate to the psychedelics too. But so I came to this basically an atheist, or at least a very skeptical agnostic. And that was my family. So it took a lot of convincing of my skeptical parts to believe a lot of what I'm about to talk about. But the first inkling that there was something beyond the material world involved with this process was as I would work with self, as I would help particularly clients who had horrible, horrible childhoods and histories, as we got their parts to open space and self would emerge spontaneously and hadn't been damaged whatsoever. It was the same self that would emerge in people who hadn't had terrible childhoods and had decent parenting. And I couldn't reconcile that. I certainly couldn't reconcile that with basic attachment theory, which says to have any of those C-word qualities, you had to have had some kind of good parenting at some point in your life, or you got it from a therapist, or you got it from spouse. And I was finding it in people who had been tortured on a daily basis as kids. There was no way to account for that through basic psychology. And so at some point I started to look around, and it turned out that most spiritual traditions had a word for it. It wasn't necessarily self, although that is what it's called in Hinduism, self or Atman. But Buddha nature in Buddhism, or Christ consciousness in Christianity, or so on. I co-authored a book where we went through each spiritual tradition and saw the analogs. And so then I started believing that that's what this was, that this was some kind of spiritual essence that, again, couldn't be damaged and knew how to heal. And as I explored more of that, it was about the time I hooked up with this woman who can channel my guides. And so I would ask a lot of questions about all that. And what I learned was that, I just went to see the movie Oppenheimer. And there's a lot about quantum physics and that. And one of the lines is that light is both a particle and a wave simultaneously. And so that's the analogy I use for self, that self is a particle. The self in each of us is a particle of the big self, which is something that really transcends each of us. And other systems might call God or the non-dual or whatever you want to call it. And that's also what I've experienced with psychedelics, because I can take moderate dose ketamine and really leave my body and enter that non-dual and really feel what it's like to be without boundaries and be in that bliss state of total connection. And then feel what happens when I come back into my body, and how, oh my God, there's this time thing, and there's these body keeps you isolated. You don't feel the connections you felt there. So for me, that's the biggest aspect of the spirituality of IFS, that what I'm calling self is just a particleized version of the big self. And that the more we unburden, the more we can access that, which means the more we can access the transcendent level as well. And all of that, for me, is a lot of what IFS is designed to do, is to bring more self to this plane and to help people relate to each other that way more, but also I believe it can have an impact just on the level of polarization in the world. If the more self we bring, the better. So that's one aspect of the spirituality of it.
And now I really need to see Oppenheimer more urgently. I've been intrigued because of his kind of fascination with Hinduism and the Bhagavad Gita, where he even supposedly recited a verse before the atomic bomb went off to relieve the tension inside of him on what was happening.
There was that about the destroyer. I can't remember the words exactly.
Yeah,
but
I am become death, destroyer of worlds, something like that.
Destroyer of worlds, that's right. Yeah, and the movie makes it clear that he didn't know that this wouldn't set off some kind of firestorm in the whole world.
Mm.
There was that possibility. So
I'm curious, Dick, you know, talking about how, you know, these victims of child abuse and torture, and that you didn't expect to find self there, this capital S self that you talk about, but you did. Have you ever worked with somebody where they really couldn't connect with self? Like you couldn't get there?
Well, I've worked with clients where their protectors pulled them out of therapy before we could. So that's true. But I've worked with, there was a period of maybe 20 years where I really wanted to see the limits of what IFS could do. And so I recruited the toughest clients I could find to work with. Mm-hmm. And I wound up working with lots of DID clients personality disorders and so on, with really severe symptoms and horrible childhoods. And it was those clients that, if I hung in there with them and their protectors came to trust me, that made me convinced that, you know, that it's in everybody. So I can't say that I've gotten there with everybody, but I've gotten there with everybody who hung in there long enough for their protectors to open space. I've never done it where the protectors open space and there was nobody there. So put it that way.
Yeah, and that reminds me of something else I wanted to get your thoughts on. Given the really impressive and exciting rise in popularity of IFS and other people wanting to do trainings who haven't gotten in yet, and people starting to try this out in their therapy practice or coaching practice, even without formal training or mentorship, I'm wondering, what are some of the pitfalls or risks in terms of like triggering more protector parts or making things even more difficult? If you have some advice there.
That's a big, big concern of ours, because as you're saying, it's become enormously popular. We have a massive waiting list of people trying to get into trainings. And the reason we structured the trainings the way they are is because it is a very delicate thing to invite people to go into these very vulnerable places. Especially the population I was just talking about,
mm-hmm.
have protectors that if screw up somehow, or if you try to go to their exiles too quickly, they'll be hell to pay. And I learned that the hard way, because some of these clients, because early on I thought, let's go to these suffering young parts, and they're the ones that need to be healed. And I would encourage clients to go there right away. And we would succeed, but the aftermath was pretty brutal and scary. And so I almost backed away from the whole phenomena because it seemed like I was doing damage. And I come from this medical family with first do no harm kind of motto. So, and then I got curious and asked what I was doing wrong. And I learned all the protectors' fears and all their issues and learned how to address all those. And so now we go to those very raw places, but only after we have permission from the protector parts. And now we don't have the backlash. And, you know, I've been trying to bring this also to psychedelics, because for me, the impact of psychedelics often is putting the manager parts and protectors to sleep. So you get a whole lot of self available, but that's a big invitation to all these exiles to come in and get attention. And if the protectors wake up and see that's happened, there's going to be hell to pay. So I've been trying to get people in the prep sessions to actually work with protective parts and their fears. Like, just ask the question, what are you afraid would happen if you go on this journey? And then address those fears. Say, this is how we're going to handle this one. That's how we're going to handle that. And in doing that, in the ketamine and IFS journeys we've done, people don't have the bad trips or the, you know, the backlash that other people talk about having. So I've got a little bit off topic here, but I forget the original question.
No, that's a good tangent, and one I know Steve and I have both been curious about. Steve, you made it to Dick's lecture in Denver at the MAPS conference. I had a conflict and was bummed, but may not have even got in if I tried, I hear.
Yeah, I don't think you would have. I was fortunate to get there early, but Dick was delayed on his presentation because they were trying to get people out of the aisles for fire code. I was surprised they didn't give you the main stage, given how popular this stuff is. But it was great. You were able to show an actual demonstration of some couples work with some people with ketamine. And I'm so glad you brought up this risk of putting the protectors or the managers to sleep against their will, because I've seen that in some of my own psychedelic therapy clients, where if preparation hasn't been thorough enough, not only a couple of things can happen. The trip itself can be a quote unquote bad trip because, you know, the protectors or managers perhaps are resisting the anesthesia, so to speak. And, or if they are successfully subdued, yeah, they come back angry. And you can backslide quite a bit, but I am curious, Dick, what is it that you really, really like, or you're excited about, combining IFS with ketamine and maybe perhaps other psychedelics?
Yeah, you know, I was first invited to experiment with by a guy named Phil Wolfson, and at first I thought, you know, I don't know that we need it. We do pretty well on our own, and maybe it would help some people if they get stuck. But in that first, maybe 2 years ago, that first round retreat we did, I was kind of amazed at how much we could do in 10 or 15 minutes after. Well, there were two doses. So there's the low dose, which I showed the video of with a couple, where people don't leave. They're just kind of in this very open state. And then the medium to high dose, they do leave for like 20 to 40 minutes. And then when they come back, there's in a lot of self. And I was amazed that they could access that much self, and we could do in 10 or 15 minutes what it would take maybe 3 or 4 sessions to do. And that's borne out now. We've done, I think, a total of 4 of these retreats now. And yeah, I'm very excited by that combination. And it isn't just that we can do a lot of healing in that time, but also that people get more access to the big self, and they get these major downloads about their lives and what they're here to do, and the sense of, you know, death is just a transition, and, and all of that. So that is all very exciting to me.
Yeah, maybe we could get into some of the specifics a little more, because we work with ketamine in both those ways as well, like psycholytic doses before a therapy session, or bigger doses, whether it's an injection or otherwise, for a journey, and the processing and an integration after. But I'm wondering, besides getting to know the fears, what else do you do to set the stage for an IFS informed ketamine journey? How do you prepare someone?
Yeah. You know, we do some visioning also and trying to get a solid intention going in but in addition to, because, you know, I think MAPS probably does some version of that and other systems, but in addition to getting the vision or the intention, to have the person go in and just check with all their parts and see if everybody's on board with that. And if not, what's the issue, and try to work it out and even modify the vision according to what feedback you're getting from the person's parts that way. So that's very useful, it seems. And also helping people know that even though you have this goal as you go into it, it may go some entirely different place. And so work with any parts that might be disappointed first.
Yeah, that's a big deal in some of the psychedelic studies we're doing, where they are placebo controlled trials, and you go into a long dosing day with a very real chance of getting a placebo dose. But managing disappointment is such a big important factor for anyone going into these. I also wanted to get your thoughts on bad trips. I say that with quotes. Difficult trips from an IFS perspective. Are there types of trips where it's protectors gone wild or other phenomena?
Yeah, so I would say those are the two different kinds of bad trips. One is where a protector refused to go to sleep, and in some cases, the person doesn't have any kind of experience. These protectors have the power to override the psychedelic in some cases. But they also, if they... some of these parts are going to punish the client during the journey, and we'll do it in hypercritical ways, or we'll take them into scary places, and mainly because they're mad that they're doing this. If they didn't give permission, or they didn't know what they were where you were headed with it, or they see you're going to some exile without their permission. Or they backlash after the journey. But there's also what might be considered bad trips that are the product of the exiles coming in and overwhelming the person. So it looks like they're having a panic attack, for example, just one example. And the facilitator doesn't know what to do with that, because they think they are having a panic attack. And so the facilitator tries to get them out of it, which only sends the message to the exile that it's doing damage, it has to leave. And whereas if instead the facilitator said, oh, I see there's this exile part that's come in, it's blended with the client, and let me talk to it. And I would just say, oh, I see you're really scared and you're here, and I get that you are stuck someplace that's really terrifying, and we're here to help you. And it would help us help you if you wouldn't mind separating your energy from Steve for a second so he can be with you too. And when we do that, we find, boom, we get self is there and can start to help the exile. Whereas if you think it's a panic attack, all of your protectors are going to influence and make the part even more scary. So it's things like that I think IFS helps that whole psychedelic territory have a non-pathologizing and empowering map.
It's one of the things I like the best about your model, Dick, is this non-pathologizing aspect of it. Like the title of your book, No Bad Parts, speaks to that really, really well. And it's been such a relief for a lot of people I've worked with to to be told that these parts that they vilified, like I wish I could just go in and cut this addicted part out of me, or cut this eating disorder part out of me. I wish I could destroy it, but to change their own perspective about it, to see, is it trying to spare them from something or trying to protect them from something? And it's almost miraculous to see those, like the panic attack example you've given, to see those parts relax when you bring this self energy that you describe to them.
Yeah, that's really true. You know, we all had to read the book in high school, Lord of the Flies.
Yeah.
And that's what it's like. You know, they're all pretty young and they're trying their best, but they're in over their heads and they get into it with each other, and they're just dying for some grown up to come along and say, calm down, everybody. We got this. We're going to get you out of here. And you don't have to do these very extreme things. And so when self shows up, it's very comforting to parts who didn't think there was anybody and they're like that, to see there is somebody who can lead us and somebody we can trust, although it takes time for a lot of parts to really start to trust self, because you know, self has been obscured for so many years and didn't protect them when they needed it. And so there are apologies that have to happen and sort of repairs with the parts too.
Yeah, I wonder, and share something with you, see if you agree, like, one of the I think the powerful experiences that people have with certain psychedelics is a lived experience of self. So especially if self has been obscured, like you said, to yeah. Actually, I mean, I've had ketamine clients say, this was the first time ever in my memory that I actually like was able to look at myself with compassion, or like, right. I could love my body or something like that.
That's right. Yeah. That I think is, particularly for the clients that never have experienced it, like you said, that is one of the most powerful aspects of psychedelics. Because with those clients, it could take another year of trying to convince protectors to open space before they would experience self. So just the knowledge that that's who they really are and that that is in there really expedites the whole process.
Yeah, and to tell them that that is who they really are, some people are skeptical. Like, well, I just felt that way because I was on a drug. Like, you altered my brain chemistry. That's why I felt right. That way.
Yeah. No, that's right. But I'll say, yeah, the brain chemistry did alter your brain to allow you to experience who you really are. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
I'm curious to know, Dick, what do you think, we've been talking about ketamine, and that's one of the medicines we have the most access to because of its legal status. But what about MDMA? I remember hearing Bessel van der Kolk talk about his early skepticism that MDMA-assisted therapy would actually be able to help these people with childhood trauma, with developmental trauma, and then he was pleasantly surprised that it was actually really effective. Do you think MDMA does something different? Do we need to prepare in the same way that you're talking about with ketamine, so that when these protectors and managers are taken offline, they don't rebel when they come back? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's pretty similar. I haven't worked with clients with MDMA, but I've had personal experiences with it. And so for me, the couple things. One is you don't leave your body, you stick around. So you access a huge amount of compassion and sense of being connected to other people, which at least in my one trip with a facilitator, I was telling her how much I loved her and all that. So you all your boundaries go away, which without a good therapist can be a problem. And there has been this history of people taking advantage of people on MDMA as a result. But it does seem to access those qualities in self particularly. And then when you do help steer a person toward a part, which they, I've talked to Michael Mithoffer a lot, who is an IFS therapist and was one of the primary investigators in the MAPS work. Mm-hmm. And he kept track of how often when people took MDMA, they spontaneously started doing IFS. And he found with high dose MDMA, it was about 80% of people. So that was very validating to me because it made me think I just stumbled onto a way we already know how to heal ourselves if our protectors get out of the way. So for me, MDMA, I think, is similar. There is, for me, a bit of a downside, and there's a hangover kind of effect for 3 days or so. At least that's what I experienced. I've heard that that's not uncommon, that you don't get with ketamine. And it's, you know, a longer trip. It can be an all-day affair. So my preference is ketamine for those reasons.
And do you go further back with Michael Mitoff, or did I hear you or him say once that there was a training relationship or overlap of some kind? Or did you meet him when he trained in IFS?
I think I met him when I did the training he and his wife were a part of. Think that was when we first met, but I could be wrong.
Yeah, cool. And how about other medicines? You know, as I mentioned, we're working with a number of psychedelic studies and even more coming down the pipeline. Like there are DMT studies that'll be done in research clinics before too long. Wondering how you see some of these others and their potential to pair with IFS.
Yeah. So psilocybin, I'm very interested in. I haven't used it with clients, but I've had some experiences myself, and mm-hmm. I find that it can be similar to ketamine in a lot of ways, and that I was able to do a lot of work when I was taking it myself. There's a guy who I won't mention his name, but he was at the psychedelics conference and has been experimenting with what he calls micro low dose 5-MAO. Uh-huh. And raves about the effects. And he gave me a dose of that, and I was impressed, actually.
What kind of state of consciousness? Like, I'm curious, what was that like?
I didn't feel altered that much. I just mm-hmm. sort of felt like I'm laying here, and here come my parts. And okay.
Wow.
And that's what he said, you know, and it's very short, you know, it takes about the time of a session, and you don't feel that different after you leave, you know, it's not.
Mm-hmm.
So he's a big promoter of that. And by microdose, I mean the tiny amount. Yeah.
Yeah. I know in some 5-MEO circles, there's this concept of, you know, a handshake dose, a hug dose, and a full dose. The full being the complete obliteration of one's ego, or however you want to describe it. But those handshake and hug low doses, where sometimes people use them to get to know the medicine in the preparation. But yeah, it's really intriguing to think about the therapeutic potential of psycholytic anything, right? The lower doses facilitating the work with these meds.
Yeah. And I do think that there are different purposes for the different doses, and that both mm-hmm. are valuable. But just for the acceleration of healing, I think the microdosing can be very valuable.
Yeah.
The access to more self, or the access to the transcendent levels, I think is also very valuable in itself. And particularly for some kind of clients, like depressed people, I think that can pull them out of that, just to get past the shell they got themselves in and touch something transcendent.
Yeah,
by itself can really make a difference.
Yeah, I agree with that completely, and just as time goes by, I have just this growing appreciation for the role of spirituality in recovery and treatment of mental health conditions and getting to a place of wellness personally and with our clients. And I know we've talked about it with IFS specifically and a little bit with IFS and psychedelics, but wondering if you have any thoughts to share on the mystical experience that psychedelics can occasion and what to do with that or how to make sense of that from an IFS perspective.
Yeah. So in addition to tasting what I'm calling the big self, I've had personal experience with, and clients have had experiences where what we've come to call guides manifest and have very clear messages for the client. And yeah, that can be very profound also and can start an ongoing relationship. Like a number of my clients have regular relationships with these guides that they check in with now and then. And there was one ketamine experience I had where the people around me, including my wife, heard me say, I won't forget, you know, when I was really up there. And then as I'm coming back, I started saying, don't leave me. And my wife said, I won't. And I said, I'm not talking to you. So yeah, there do seem to be these spiritual entities, sometimes ancestors, that can be very, very helpful, I find.
And Dick, what would you say to the people listening who aren't spiritual, aren't religious, who are hearing us talk in this way? Some of the mental health purists who would rather leave spirituality out of the conversation when we're talking about mental health. Maybe they're biological reductionists and they just, you know, they think a bit differently. What might you say to them to maybe loosen them up around the edges?
I don't know that I can loosen them up. I tend to not impose any of this on, I mean, there are a number of people coming to our trainings like that. And so we don't actively talk about this stuff at the level one training, sometimes more in the level threes. So it's not something that you have to believe in to do IFS. I just find it really, really valuable. And the more people do IFS, the more they're going to encounter these phenomena. Because I didn't believe any of this going into it. But I'm a good scientist. My father's, who was a big scientist, advice to me always was follow the data, even if it takes you way outside your paradigm. Mm. So I ask of people is, as you try this, keep your mind open, ask questions, see if this very wise, what seemed to be a part, if you ask it, are you a part or something else? Just, you know, don't necessarily discount the answer, because they'll often say, no, I'm not a part, I'm something else.
Yeah, I appreciate the curiosity, because this is just for me personally, and anybody who's listened to our show, you know, more than a few episodes will hear me talk about my skepticism, but also desire to experience transcendence and my desire for there to be something bigger that connects us all. And in our recent episode, Reed and I talked about this article that came out about the potential for psychedelics to solicit, quote, false beliefs, right? That people can come out of psychedelic experiences believing things that maybe aren't in service of them or in service of others, or are just not measurable, not verifiable, and can take them down potentially destructive paths. So I like the empirical approach, following the data, but the data that we have is also a little squishy. You know, it's self-report data. It's people are filling out questionnaires describing what a mystical experience might be like. So it's tough. It's tough to study something that is only experienced phenomenologically inside the person's mind and soul, right? We got Carhartt Harris's work on, you know, brain imaging and things like that, but that doesn't always necessarily correlate with experience. So it's a tricky tricky scientific subject to study.
Totally agree. And, you know, I had a massive skeptical part, which I think is partly why I was picked to lead this, because I didn't just believe. I had to see it proven over and over and over before that skeptic would give me a break. So I share that with you.
Yeah, well, I guess you're hearing my skeptical part at the microphone.
All parts are welcome.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, on the topic of psilocybin, and tying it back into eating disorders where we started, earlier this week, a paper came out, the first report from a clinical trial of psilocybin for anorexia. It was out of UCSD, Walter Kay and colleagues, and in collaboration with Compass. And it was a small study, and there was just one dose. And it was not wildly significant. The statistically significant changes were in kind of subscales of bigger rating scales or trending towards significance. And while it is a small study, it kind of reminded me of how much resistance there is in working with certain conditions like anorexia, and how maybe more, not only more doses are needed, but some radical approach to the therapy paired with it. And I'm just, with that in mind, I know it's a topic you and I have spoken about for many months, and it's on my wish list to do, you know, IFS plus psilocybin and other medicines for eating disorders. But wondering, you know, how you'd approach, you know, a course of psychedelic therapy with clients like that, with a very difficult to treat, maybe rigid condition, anorexia, OCD, for example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and this speaks to something we haven't talked about yet, which is what the problem, one of the problems I see with the psychedelics field is there's so much emphasis on the medicine as the healing agent. And for me, the medicine opens a door, but if you don't follow up and do a lot of therapy around it, it's going to be a wasted opportunity. And so I'm not surprised that they didn't have great results with anorexia. But if you know, they had an IFS therapist with the person and they did get some access to self, then we would have them turn toward the anorexic part and get curious about it and do all the stuff I was talking about around the binging part, which I've done with many, many anorexic clients, and wind up appreciating mm-hmm. it for trying to protect and learn about what it's protecting and heal those parts. And I've had really good luck with anorexia without psychedelics, but I imagine that it would just expedite it. It would make it, because mm-hmm. a lot of times those anorexic parts, partly because everybody's tried to get rid of them for so long, and every therapist they've encountered has been doing that, it takes a long time for them to trust that you're not trying to do that, because these parts honestly believe they're saving the client's life, even though they're actually killing the client. And, mm-hmm. and they would rather the client die from starving this way than die from the feelings they're trying to contain. So a lot of these anorexic clients, or clients who have anorexic parts, the part believes the stakes are really high and that it's got to fight to save the client's life. And so it takes a while of you showing up in self as a therapist, and also mm-hmm. the psychedelics helping separate it from the client, because they're usually very, what we call, blended with the anorexic part.
Mm-hmm.
It takes a while before that part can drop its guard.
Yeah, that all makes sense. A while in speaks to the importance of lots of preparation, more dosing sessions, and that it's not a one and done integration task either, for sure. Yeah.
And it's particularly not a one and done if the attitude toward the anorexic part doesn't change, you know? So you get a little separation from it, you get a little self relative to it, but you're still going to have people telling you to try and get rid of it. So that's not going to get you very far.
Yeah,
I love this idea of studying specific therapies like IFS for specific conditions with particular medicines. Because right now in the clinical trial world, it's the assumption is more that, like you said before, Dick, that the medicine is the mechanism of change. And that's a lot of these studies aren't even calling what we do in the room with these research participants therapy, right? It's it's support, or we're monitoring, which are important. Hard to tease apart those human variables, though, and to see which one is really accounts for the most change. But I hope that there, as the research moves forward, we can actually study specific therapies like IFS with specific medicines.
I would love that. And, you know, Reed, if you do that with eating disorders, I'd be happy to consult or help in whatever way I could.
Well, I will definitely take you up on that, because I think the work is, is certainly beginning here and exciting. And I mentioned that pilot we did recently of group ketamine. It was in this room I'm sitting in, actually, where we did the talk sessions. And then down the hall, we have a bigger group space for dosing. But we used IFS as the model paired with ketamine, and it really just blew all of us away, the participants, facilitators, in how profound and meaningful it was. One gentleman, I may have told this to Steve in an earlier chat, but one gentleman who was a performer singer and had lost his kind of ability and drive for singing, and even was seeing a doctor for some like vocal cord tension and things like that. And towards the end of this three dose and a couple month cohort we did, he reported on some kind of miraculous loosening of his vocal cords and a doctor's visit. And by the last closing session was getting up and singing a song to all of us, where we were all in tears in this room. And throughout the course of it, people said over and over, I can't count how many times, like that this part language was game changing for their ability to look at themselves and converse about their experience in life and in the sessions we did together.
I'm thrilled to hear that. And I'm just really, really excited that you guys are experimenting this way. And like I said, I'd be happy to keep consulting or helping.
Cool. And that brings up another question I had. Do you have anything on your wish list of kind of academically, what questions to answer about IFS and psychedelics, or IFS and anything for that matter, any research topics that are front and center for you, or you'd put out there to the world?
I'm very interested in the power of that combination with things like eating disorders or very severe kinds of problems. You know, I'm heartened to see the impact on depression and anxiety, things like that. You know, I think it has potential for all kinds of symptoms. So that would be one. And then the whole question of dosing and what's the best dose to combine with IFS with what kind of client, what level of protector they have, what kind of access do they have on their own to self? So those questions are still very pressing for me. And we are trying to fool around with that to some degree in these retreats, but not doing official research by any means.
Yeah, and I would throw out another kind of thing from my end of the more we have some questionnaire, survey, especially validated instruments to query things like the amount of self-energy on board that we could look at before or after, during a given session, or anything along those lines would be so helpful in shining a light on some of these questions we're brainstorming on.
Yeah, there is a woman who designed a self-leadership scale whose name escapes me now, but it might be on our website. I'm not sure, but and she had some validation of it. And
cool. I will. Yeah, I'll go looking. I did try one out when I was in the training that may have been that, like a self-leadership questionnaire or something. Yeah,
that might be it. Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. Awesome. Well, what else did you have while we've got Dick in the hot seat, Steve? Any burning questions?
Yeah, I've got one. I think a lot of people have been exposed to you by your appearances on some popular podcasts. Like, I remember I heard you take Tim Ferriss through some parts work. I've heard you take Aubrey Marcus through parts work. And I love that that's often what you do on these shows is, you know, people be asking you questions and you'll just say, let's do it. Let's show people how it works. And props to these folks who've been willing to, you know, be vulnerable on their shows. Totally. It's really beautiful to see it in motion. Is there anything, given that it has this broad exposure now and people will dip their toes in, is there anything that you think people generally misunderstand about IFS or that they get wrong that that you'd like to clarify?
You mean after the podcast or during, or do you mean in general as a myth about
it? I think like the general public. I'm just thinking, because, you know, my first exposure to IFS, it's feeling a lot like the Gestalt work that I've done. It's feeling a lot like the chair work, but I'm a therapist, right? I'm a psychologist, but the general public hears this. They're like, wow, he got Tim Ferriss to talk to his inner child. That's freaking awesome. And they might want to, you know, do some of this work themselves. What does the novice get?
Yeah. So, that, again, I'm a first do no harm kind of person. So we've actually toyed lately with trying to roll it out to the public in some form. And how can we do that in a safe way? And the real misunderstandings that can come from those kind of podcasts is that people should go and do the, you know, try it on their own. And that will work for a lot of people, but there's a percentage of people with really bad backgrounds who are going to get into a lot of trouble that way. And so we're really trying to encourage people that it's pretty safe to work with protectors, but if you're going to go to exiles, you need to have somebody who knows what they're doing with you. And, so that's, as we bring this, for example, to executive coaches, we're going to be running trainings for them. We're letting them know with your executive coach, help them get to know their protectors and their self. And like I was saying earlier, help them learn how to talk to their parts about giving them access to self. But have them go to a therapist if they're going to go deeper than that. So that's, I think, the main misunderstanding that I would try to address is the idea that you can do all the healing you need to do by yourself. So, and some, you know, it's hard because some people can, amazingly, but some people are going to get in a big load of trouble if they try even.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah, that caution makes a lot of sense, and it's one I've thought about. Even with novice therapists who maybe don't go through the level one training, they don't get thoroughly trained. Maybe they've read a couple of your books.
It drives me crazy that that's the case. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, Dick, anything else that you want to share with our audience or anything that you'd like to talk about as we wrap up?
Just that I love the work you guys are doing and I want to support it. And this has been a lot of fun. And, you know, you got me talking about things I don't often talk about. So that's good.
Yeah, cool. That's the goal, right? we've talked quite a bit about IFS on our show. We've even tried our hand while Reed was going through level one training, just sort of doing a short episode on IFS. So it's nice to have the godfather, the founder of IFS here to talk about it. So thank you so much for sharing your time with us, Dick.
Yeah, really enjoyed it, guys.
Thanks, Dick. Always a pleasure. Take care.
Look forward to further adventures.
Mm-hmm. Likewise.
Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers is brought to you by Numinous, a mental wellness company committed to tackling the global mental health crisis by delivering best-in-class psychedelic-assisted therapies, contributing to the body of primary and clinical psychedelic research, and fostering healing through community connection and social responsibility. You can learn more about Numinous at numinous.com. That's N-U-M-I-N-U-S.com. If you enjoyed the show today and you want to support us, here's how you do it. Rate and review the show on platforms like Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Subscribe to the Numinous YouTube channel, like the videos, and share it. Share the show or clips of the show with someone that you think will enjoy it. Hey listeners, it's Steve Thayer here, letting you know that Numinous offers unique training opportunities for mental health practitioners to develop their skills and expertise in offering psychedelic-assisted therapy to clients. These courses are carefully crafted by Numinous professionals like myself, Reed, Joe, and others, and offer a variety of high-quality learning experiences. So, if you would like to learn more about these trainings, you can find the link in the show notes below, or you can visit numinous.com/training. That's numinous.com/training. The content of this podcast does not constitute medical advice or mental health treatment. Consult with a medical or mental health professional if you believe you are in need of mental health treatment.